You are listening to the Effective Statistician Podcast, the weekly podcast with Alexander Schacht and Benjamin Pieske, designed to help you reach your potential, lead great science, and serve patients while having a great work-life balance. In addition to our premium courses on the Effective Statistician Academy, we also have lots of free resources for you across all kind of different topics within that academy. Head over to theeffectivestatistician.com and find the academy and much more for you to become an effective statistician. I'm producing this podcast in association with PSI, a community dedicated to leading and promoting the use of statistics within the healthcare industry for the benefit of patients. Join PSI today to further develop your statistical capabilities with access to the ever-growing video-on-demand content library, free registration to all PSI webinars, and much, much more. Head over to the PSI website at psiweb.org to learn more about PSI activities and become a PSI member today. Welcome everybody to this DITEL webinar. I am super excited that Benjamin and myself as hosts of the Effective Statistician do this together with DITEL today. Let's first start with an introduction. I'm Alexander Schacht. I'm host of the Effective Statistician podcast. I have been 20 years with the pharmaceutical industry, worked in academia as well as in the CRO. And I love everything around leadership. And with that, I want to hand over to Flaminia.
Yes. Thank you, Alexander. My name is Flaminia. I'm a statistician. I work at DITEL since approximately 6 years. I have a similar background to Alexander. I've worked in pharma, academia, roles in different countries in the last 25 years. I'm very happy to be here because I'm also very interested in leadership, management, and innovation. So let's see what we can get out of this chat.
Let's turn over to Yannis.
Hey, everyone. I'm really excited to be here. I'm Yannis Jamaya, Chief Scientific Officer at DITEL and a statistician by training. Similar to Alexander and Flaminia, I've been in the industry for 20 years about or more, and very excited to see it evolving, to see how our profession is developing and gaining prominence. We have so much to bring to how clinical trials are evolving and where we're headed. And so I think this conversation is going to be really exciting.
And finally, not lastly, Benjamin, great to have you on the call as well.
Thanks, Alexander. It's been a while co-hosting this, so it's a pleasure to have a chance now in a different setting as a webinar and podcast together. That's very exciting. And yeah, my background is, you know, statistician by training, more than 20 years now in the industry, but I skipped all the academics. I'm right to CRO and stayed there since 20 years. So that is my experience. And I'm, you know, heading our biostatistics department in DITEL in the project-based services, PBS, which is the execution of the trial. So it's a very exciting occasion to be here and to have this chat and looking out not only to what has changed, but really what's going to change. And that is an exciting today.
Let's get started. The topic of today is the future of statisticians in the evolving pharmaceutical and healthcare landscape. What kind of changes have we seen in the recent years? I think these evolving trends will have an even bigger impact in the coming years. Yeah. Do you have seen in terms of CTs changing in the last 5 years? What are the bigger trends that you have seen?
Different ones. Many, first of all, I would say change of the target indications. So we are looking more and more towards rare or rarer diseases and more genetically identified diseases. Yeah, that's one. So the indication.
Definitely, lots of companies put rare diseases as one of their key target indications. As we know, rare diseases are actually not that rare. If you can identify them, especially with gene differentiation, that's definitely a bigger point.
Well, you mentioned the therapies that go up with these rare diseases, the gene therapies, immunotherapies, cellular therapies for rare diseases. The focus shifted from the clinician point of view to the patient, because by involving more patient advocacy groups and define special endpoints that are maybe more targeted to the heterogeneity of the patients.
That's a very good point. There are lots of dates in terms of guidelines regarding patient-reported outcomes, which are now, the abbreviation has actually changed in the last years as well. So before that, we have talked about PROs. Now we talk about COAs. That's yet another change. Yannis, what kind of other changes have you seen?
Thanks. I think we're talking about RCTs, but really the broader picture is clinical trials in general. We see a lot of trials that are single-arm studies that use external control arms, for example, trying to leverage all the data that exists in the healthcare system but is not necessarily channeled through randomized clinical trials or even clinical trials altogether, right? So there's an increasing need to use all the data, real-world data that is available. Obviously, trying to do that in clinical development, but there's also an increased concern with reimbursement and how to ensure that you get market access. It's not sufficient to get the drugs approved. You also need to make sure that the healthcare systems and payers will be able to support that. We're seeing a lot more of benefit cost as well as benefit risk. All this feels like it's converging. There's a lot of innovation in statistics on methodology. We have, of course, the whole field of AI that's blowing up, and people are wondering, you know, how do we leverage this? How do we make the most of it, make our lives better, simpler, or derive better insights from all this data? It's quite incredible, the insights that can come from a machine looking at large quantities of data.
Completely agree. Benjamin, what would you extend on these kind of points?
Yeah, I think we touched quite a number of things already in terms of what we observed and where we currently are in the process. But what we didn't really touch on is the people, right? The statisticians. So what did we expect, or what did you, and now I'm asking Flaminia again, it's more on the operation side, is how did you see that the statisticians, the requirements on the statisticians change over time?
Well, 20 years ago, the statistician was working in silos, in his own small team, and doing his own work for specific focused objectives. Nowadays, I see this changing greatly. There's much more need for collaboration, for flexibility, adaptability, really in terms of mindset. The statistician needs to be open to innovation, like Yannis mentioned, so should be up to date with digital fluency, you know, being digital fluent. At least know some of the options that are out there on the market in terms of AI, neural networks, machine learning techniques. Not necessarily being able to use them, to do them, to create them, but being able to know when to use them and where. Collaboration. Again, I come back to the first point that there's a need of collaborating with data scientists and developers of innovative techniques. In terms of personality, a statistician needs to be proactive, needs to be optimistic, and needs to be curious. Curiosity is one of the main points that drives innovative implementation, I would say, as well. Be open and not resistant to change, The state of the art is always scary for everyone, and we should never underestimate that. As managers, we should try to encourage change and really help sustain the people with their innovative ideas.
Completely agree. See from your face that you want to add to that.
One thing I want to give as background is, as Cytel, we did some research last year where we spoke to 30 or 40 different stakeholders in a variety of companies in North America and Europe, large, small, some regulators, some payers, and asked them, you know, where did they think that we would be 5 years, 10 years from now in terms of how we ran clinical trials. They spoke about this idea of augmented RCTs or reimagined RCTs, where we are bringing in not just the usual clinical trial methods, but trying to augment that with real world data, new technology, new methodologies, trying to push more innovation. In many cases, a lot of these innovations and ideas have been around for a couple of decades, at least the time I've been in the industry, but somehow they feel like they're really coming together and accelerating. And I think in the last couple of years, especially. So the natural question after that is, of course, who are the people who are going to work in this new environment? If AI is going to replace certain aspects of programming, then what are we going to be doing instead of programming, for example? You would imagine the idea is becoming more strategic, becoming more multidisciplinary, being able to provide insights, interpret, communicate, convince other stakeholders about what needs to be done and where we're headed, and trying to bring all those pieces together. So I see what we've seen in a lot of discussion, a lot of people already moving in this direction of what we might call a clinical data scientist, who is not only a statistician, but knows some epidemiology, like some causal inference, for example, knows how to bring in real world data together with experimental clinical trial data. We need, as Flaminia mentioned, people who can feel comfortable with data science, with machine learning, with the idea of synthetic data and digital twins. And of course, programming has been exploding the open source community, and things like Copilot and AI assistants. It's a very different ballgame from when many of us were trained in programming some years ago. And I think all the other stakeholders in pharma and regulators look at statisticians to help navigate all this. We're the people who understand quantitative methods, along with some of our colleagues in epi and health economics and so on. But this class of quantitative data scientists, if you like, are really the guide to this new future and can help to set the boundaries of what's acceptable, what's not acceptable, what's right and wrong, biased. We've been doing that for many years, but I think our time has come to shine, really.
I think, as you mentioned there, all these different data rules, roles, yeah, like epidemiologists, pharmacologists, real-world evidence, clinical trial statisticians, people that know inside out, machine learning. My perception is there's the convergence here. Yes, these kind of silos are not that strict anymore. And I also see that these departments don't sit completely separated from each other in different functions, but I see a couple of different companies who have built an umbrella organization, put all these different quantitative scientists together. I know a couple of different companies that have went that way. And so it's much easier to align from an organizational point of view and to collaborate, because methods that have been used, for example, primarily in real-world evidence and in epidemiology, like causal inference, are now used more and more in clinical trials with the Ethimon framework.
Yeah.
So programming that's used, machine learning used in real-world evidence parts or in epidemiology is now also used in statistics. Some of those, they will, it actually comes from statistics originally. So it's, I think this kind of, this to say, I'm only working on that, and I'm only working on yet another thing. You can't say that anymore.
You can't, but I do think that, you know, there are different personality types. There are people who are more detail-oriented and more abstract thinkers. And I think you need to be able to touch and understand a lot of these points and understand how other function, how they're needed. Yet there'll also always, or at least for foreseeable future, be some level of specialization where some people are better at getting a phase 3 trial past a regulatory hurdle versus being creative in exploratory settings where you're analyzing data and trying to generate hypotheses, which I think is tricky, right? Because you need to be able to juggle a lot of these things, yet people are not always comfortable in all these areas because just personality types, right? So it connects with this whole idea of leadership, because leadership is an area where some people are uncomfortable,
right? When I hear you talking about the mindset and the different aspects that a statistician or like a quantitative scientist is needed to fulfill, I'm kind of worried that we are running out of them. If you filter for the different attributes, let's say, that you need to bring along as the future statistician, it will be rare, right? So that's why I think we have a big need in getting statisticians trained, open up to other aspects, to other ideas. You know, as Flaminia said before about the, thinking and curiosity, things where we really have to help as managers, as leaders in the industry to support this, to develop further. Because otherwise, looking back 20 years, we kind of have the introverted statistician on a computer. That's not the future role. So we have a lot more to consider, and it's much bigger thinking behind, aspect of in looking into our future as data scientists or statisticians.
But a statistician cannot be an expert in everything. And because we are statisticians, we are very oriented towards the details. So we really want to know and understand a model or a test or a method. So it gives us uncomfort not to know and staying on the surface of things. Nevertheless, these days, the methodologies, the designs of trials, the mass of data ask for this holistic view of real-world evidence together with RCTs, with innovative techniques like adaptive Bayesian methods, which we don't necessarily need to know by heart, I think. Mm. We collaborate with people that know how to use them, and we have to know how to sit at a strategic table with the biotech and all stakeholders to actually find the right solution for that specific
problem. Yeah, I was just going to say that is probably where the collaboration comes in, right? Breaking down the silos and really have the cooperation between, the designers, the statisticians who are more focused on the methodologies, the executors, then, outside, like later on, market access, RWE, anything that comes along across in all directions, also regarding when we use innovative technologies. It's not necessarily that we need to be expert in it, but it's really about knowing who and collaborating with.
I think I basically see two different trends here. On the one hand, we have all these fancy statistical methods like Bayesian borrowing. We have these digital twin things. We have digital health applications, many more patient-reported outcomes, these kind of things. My perception is we have, and I see that also in pharmaceutical companies as well as in CROs, groups of experts that have a very, very deep knowledge in a narrow space because there's so much change going on. And to keep up with these different things, you need to have some kind of focus. Same if you look into Bayesian designs and phase 1, phase 2. Yeah, there's a new publication coming out. It feels like daily on a new kind of trial design. Specialists need to work together with, I think, more generalist type clinical data scientists that have an overview of what is possible and work closely with non-quantitative functions like physicians, market access people, commercial people, or regulatory people. And those need to have a good way of communicating with each other. But I think especially in this latter type, these kind of more quantitative generalist type, these need to be strong leaders with very good communication skills.
I think
would you agree with that, Jonas?
I think what I'm thinking is, you know, we live in really interesting times. If you look at like big picture of what's going on in society, and some people have claimed a comeback of the Renaissance man, like Leonardo da Vinci, that does a little bit of everything. Ever since the Renaissance, there's been a lot of specialization. And not exactly today, but if you look out 5, 10, 15 years, you're going to see a lot, I think, of the special, there's a lot of specialized tasks that are going to get automated, where AI agents are going to replace many things that we do, where we may not need to know all the details. Over time, in many cases, people are a bit skeptical and don't trust new technologies and don't trust black boxes. But over time, their attention fades and people start accepting. There's so many technologies that were difficult to adopt, and now we don't even think about because we just live with them. We live with our phones, our computers, our cars, and we don't give it a second thought. The first people who were exposed to the car didn't necessarily look like the same way that we do. So I think it's difficult to imagine how these things are going to become common and accepted. But over time, a lot of these specialized functions will be available to many people. There's going to be more of a focus on this sort of generalized aspect of, you know, do you understand the bigger picture? How can you connect the dots between the various functions or the various quantitative approaches and make them work together? How do you communicate and convince people that these are the right approaches, that this is the right interpretation, analyze the pros and cons? There's a number of things that the machines are not going to be able to do, right? That we will essentially start doing ourselves.
That is a good part to dig a little bit deeper in the ghost of AI, right? It's a buzzword for a number of years now, right? So, and I'm saying buzzword kind of provocative because this is, you know, at the beginning, everyone was talking about it without knowing what it really means and the impact it has. We still don't know what impact it has. At least we get a sense of where it could be potentially used, and maybe it's already starting in some regards. Do you have any more, especially when you talk about the research that you know, kind of looking in the future? So where do you see AI in general or in specific in our role being the new car that we are driving at some point?
Yeah, it's challenging to think about that, right? Because I think use cases are coming up with use cases on a regular basis. The technology is all evolving really fast. And although it has limitations, you know, like the iPhone 10 versus the iPhone 1, a lot of problems got solved, right? So it's hard to know. I think intuitively as statisticians and so on, we see limitations and problems to the technology and wonder how will they ever get over human biases. But people are working on that and thinking about it, and the future may look very different. Primary use case in AI ML is just efficiency. You know, all these sort of processes that can be automated and maybe in the past have been automated using robotic process automation. People are looking at AI to do that, LLMs or machine learning in general. So synthesizing literature, generating documents, programming code, even being able to converse with an AI and say, hey, I need a Bayesian hierarchical model or a negative binomial regression model run my data. Can you do this for me and have it sort of create the code and then run with it? There will obviously be a human in the loop, sort of a QA step because of the industry that we work in. We may just start trusting these things more and more as they become more and more reliable. So there's all the areas that are maybe a little bit more scientific, which is how can you derive insights from data. How can you use this in diagnostics, which is already, I think, ahead of the curve? Do you have other ideas? I'm curious to hear what's like.
Yeah, I don't think we should be scared of AI. 25 years ago, I did a master thesis on image recognition for diagnostics on neural networks. The implementation of that is probably used nowadays in clinics, but in pharma and biotechs will be probably used as a second eye. But let's remember, we are a highly regulated environment. So any change cannot happen from one day to the other, although the technology changes rapidly. The changes in our environment will be slower, and we will have time to adapt and to learn. Natural language modeling. I did that when I was at IQVIA some years ago to read the electronic medical records. It's helpful, but it's still real world evidence is still not a standardized environment. The data for it. We can use them, but with care. Ideally, in the future, a standardized real world data set so that we can easily merge with one-arm trials. We are still not there, though.
It's a couple of different tasks. And you just say, kind of, on a probability from 0 to 100, how likely that will be done through AI protocol. If you have a protocol outline of a protocol, will that be done through AI?
60% of it will be done through AI.
Yannis?
I think higher, I think 80% maybe. It's not the probability that the whole thing will be written. It's like how much of it will be AI-driven versus expertise coming into it. Of course, all this depends on the time frame you're talking about.
And it depends it depends also on the input that you give to AI. And the input is set up by humans, not by AI themselves. Right. So what is the objective?
But if you have a good kind of document that outlines a protocol, I think 80-90% of it can be by AI pretty soon. Especially thinking about lots of the standard protocols that we have. But what's your take on that?
Well, I agree. It's at some point it's a quite high number. So there's some adjustments needed. But my question back to you is more on, you know, against the nature of the statistician to just trust AI, right? As Flamini said before, we need to get the data, get on ground of it. How do we build this up? The protocol is not the, you know, a stats document per se, but it's more. Next question is probably about the SAP, Alexander. How do we make sure that the statistician or that this is a trustworthy document, right? So that's why I'm a little bit, you know, like 80-90%. I would agree in principle. However, how much time do you as a statistician or a writer spend on confirming that this is correct or in line with what you expected or experienced?
Yeah, I think that'd be interesting because you can create feedback loops. You can correct things and train large language model to become better. And I agree, the protocol is just a statistics document. But in terms of the statistical analysis plan, once you have a complete written protocol, how easy will it be to create a SAP? Or actually, do we still need an SAP? Do we directly kind of, here's protocol, create all the tables and figures from it?
Yeah, I think there's a question of like, there's a journey to getting somewhere. And then once you're there, the situation will be different. In order to train these models, refine them, the feedback loop, et cetera, you need an expert who's going to say, yes, you got the right answer. No. Yep. And that has to be the statistician, I think, when you start thinking about bias, the various types of biases, being able to check whether the models are doing the right things or not. I think we're in a great place to be helping that and making sure that we get through that journey. And I think you see that in the industry when you just hear about various companies are working on AI ML initiatives and the statisticians are generally involved because they're the ones that most of the other participants feel are best placed to deal with this.
I would add, Yannis, AI is statistics. right? It is a probability model. That's also why we are the best placed to learn about AI, to use it best. But I doubt that we will disappear as statisticians. As you say, there's still the human eye and the human brain that is needed to really discern what is correct and what is not.
Alexander, I have a question for you. I know you give leadership trainings to many organizations. How have you seen changes in what's being requested of leadership given this changing environment and new tools that are coming up?
Companies, including Sitel, as of May. And in the beginning, we focused on very much on communication and presentation skills, negotiation skills, building teams, building trust, and also conflict resolution. In the last years, we were asked to also provide more training in terms of strategy. What is good strategy? What is bad strategy? What are elements of a good strategy? How can you look into sources of power within a strategy? So things like focus or leverage or design or other aspects that make strategies actually work. And how can you differentiate from a good strategy from a so-called bad strategy? Strategy is nowadays used pretty much like a buzzword, and everybody sits in a strategic role and works on a strategic document with strategic discussions in strategic governance meetings and so on. And not everything that just has this adjective strategic is actually strategic. And so helping people understand what is actually a tactic and what is a strategy, that's a definitely very, very important point. Negotiation becomes much more important as well, specifically because the pressure on statisticians and data scientists has increased quite a lot. They're much more exposed to doing lots of different tasks, and the companies want to do more with less. And so they need to negotiate about timelines, about workload, about resources all the time. This is one of the main pain points, actually, when I talk to statisticians, is the workload. It's ever increasing and the demands are really big. And of course, people know that there's lots at stake. So for negotiation skills are also one of the key aspects.
Probably delegation as well, right?
Negotiation.
It's an interesting paradox that we're increasing efficiency with things like AI, yet at the same time, people have increased workloads.
One of the key things is, and that is not going away by AI, is other discussions. I recently was at an S workshop recently, September last year, and someone said, yeah, with AI, we will, from tables and figures to a clinical trial report or to a PowerPoint presentation, much faster. But the weeks of discussions of the study team about these results, what they mean, and the next steps. I don't think that you can expedite that a lot with machine learning or generative AI.
And that would have happened in the writing of the report, right?
A small part is really affected by generative AI, the kind of the writing part and the summarizing part, and kind of converting documents into different formats, like creating an abstract out of a clinical trial report or creating a PowerPoint presentation out of a clinical trial report or having an abstract and then creating a poster for it. I think these tasks, there will be solutions that help us with that, doing these kind of 90-95% ready. Creating a discussion out of all of that and determining whether that is a benefit-risk ratio, that's yet a completely different topic. Also, lots of companies are competing against each other on many of these different indications that are kind of lead indications, even if they are rare indications. And they all come up with different designs. And so statisticians will be needed to explain, why did company A go with that design, but your company with a different design? Company C came yet with another different design. Because, you know, of course, you always want to design something perfect for your compound. As compounds are different, they of course have different designs. And that's also something you probably automate using large language models.
Well, also, I think a lot of AI relies on interpolation of existing patterns and data. So when it comes to innovation and new methods and new ideas and how to solve new problems that come along, I think that's going to be challenging, at least in the foreseeable future, till we get to the next level of artificial intelligence. But just with what exists today, it's hard to see how, when you're confronted with a new problem, a new endpoint, a new statistical challenge, you're going to have to rely on people who've been trained in statistics and know how to work these problems out.
Okay, I would say we stop here and move over to a couple of questions from the audience.
Yeah.
Because we are now about 45 minutes into the webinar, and there are lots of questions also online. Pierre, for example, asks, what is your web recipe to get enough confidence so that we are able to share evidence generated by different experts like data science, real-world evidence, epidemiology, all of that? How do we get to that confidence level? What do you think? How do we build confidence in that area? I would say we just try and do it. I think you can only build confidence working into it, leaning into it, trying it out, and of course, have good discussions with these experts so that you at least understand the big ideas. You don't need to understand all the details of how to implement these, but you need to understand the big ideas.
You know, I think it's the comfort zone that you need to leave once in a while. I really don't doubt of this. That is also where line management comes in, where we give guidance to our staff, maybe open up doors, say that is something you need to do. But actually, confidence comes with training, with the training of doing it, and not, you're not born with it. So it's really go out and try, do something new. Don't be afraid of failures. Something that everyone needs to come through at some point.
AI works like this. AI does fail and then starts again. From the failures, it learns. So that's how
we are the AI in perfection.
I think a certain amount of daring, like you said, that people need to have. The other aspect is sort of the comfort zone is very interesting. He's there that you said, Benjamin, because I think as statisticians, we always hedge our bets. Always like, oh, well, there's a 5% chance like I'm wrong. You're never 100% sure of your answers, really. But you need to act that way when communicating with other people, because others are not that comfortable with uncertainty. When they need to make decisions, just need to go ahead with that. Confidence, I think, has to come from within. The same way that we have confidence when we stop a trial with 95% predictive probability of success, we should be able to say, okay, well, I'm 90% sure this is happening. Let's do it, right?
I have another question from Nancy. That's a very controversial question. How much should a statistician compromise on basic principles? For example, replacing an RCT, including synthetic data in the analysis plan. Do you foresee regulators being okay with these kind of things?
Yeah, I don't think in the short, medium future, we're going to stray very far from where we are today. You do need to stick to basic statistical and clinical trial design principles. We've seen adaptive designs early on. The question is, when can you use adaptive designs? And at the beginning, it was really, well, you have to be able to justify that there's no other way of doing this, or this is the best way. And I think there's a little bit of that where people are experimenting with synthetic data or external control arms, uncommon sort of designs. There's usually a big justification that needs to be done to the regulators on why this is a special case, an unmet need. There's no way of recruiting the patients. You have to have all those arguments aligned. I think as people get comfortable with the methods and the reliability of the results, that may start to loosen because we see that with adaptive designs, there's not as much justification of why you need to have an interim analysis. People are starting to accept that as like, okay, we'll just do that. So maybe over time that'll change. But in the short, medium term, I think and that's why I think we talk a little bit about a reimagined RCT and not like doing away with RCTs. I don't think the RCT is going away anytime soon, if ever.
I completely agree. The RCT will not go away just because it is such a powerful tool and will not get completely rid of randomization. When I think about regulators that have been talking about, you know, single arm trials, and arguably still very, very skeptical about single arm trials that you then kind of combine with external data. It's not two extremes, having a balanced randomized trial, the single arm. There's also lots of things in between you can do. Being open for these in between will gradually probably change. I have another question here. Eric mentions that debugging codes written by AI can be quite difficult. What's your experience in that? Does it actually make more time to debug codes that is written by AI, or how do you foresee the future there?
I've never used AI for generating code, so maybe Yannis.
Yeah, and I think that's true, especially at the beginning of a technology adoption curve, that you might spend more time. Yeah, you won't get those efficiency gains right away. It can be quite difficult, especially if the code is long. I've heard some people suggest having multiple AI models. I wonder if you could generate code using, I don't know, ChatGPT, but then, you know, have Claude AI check for bugs and errors. People will come up with creative ways of doing things like that, or just even interrogating the AI to figure out where the bugs might be, what went wrong. But I think coming back to what I said earlier as well, this is a part where the statistician is needed, because a number comes out or an answer comes out and you need to be able to recognize that's wrong. Well, that's right. Let's go find out what went wrong.
Yeah, but it's a good example of why the skill set of the statistician still needs to be quite high, right? Debugging code without any knowledge, it's a big box. We need to have basic or advanced experience and expertise in that field. Even if two AIs comparing, you're still not going to debug it if you're not experienced in that field. It's a classical example of how to use it and still why the statistician will be needed. Programmer, maybe it's more programming role. Actually, another question. There are people that think that AI will replace statistician in the future, while others think AI can help part of the statistician opinion and, you know, to justify your position. I think we touched part of it, but maybe just to summarize, you know, for Flaminia and Yannis on that point.
I think AI will give us the freedom to have more time to think about the contents rather than the actual format. So just to emphasize what Yannis said, we will be able to really evaluate different strategies, methods, and the interpretation of the results. And what Alex said, if a treatment was approached with 5 different trial designs, we will have more time to evaluate why these different methods were targeted and used for that specific problem, which we don't have so much now. We are more executors of standard methods, right? And we spend hours doing the actual programming, the actual writing of a SAP, researching the endpoints, derivations. So we will have more time.
We are
real statisticians.
when you go to a governance committee to get your trial greenlighted and explain the different trial design options, you're not going to be able to say, oh, the AI came up with this option. You're going to have to explain why that's a good option, even if the AI helps you get there. People are going to want to understand the context. I don't think that's going to go away and might get more intense to try to justify what good decisions are. A lot of these tools and technologies, AI adaptive designs and synthetic data, they're all decision support tools. At the end of the day, as human beings, we're making decisions and we need as much information to make good decisions.
So we need critical thinking. That's
critical thinking and communication tools. The emphasis on the communication part is increasing. In terms of generative AI, it also depends on how you prompt them and kind of what is the extent to which you kind of let it do something. I used generative AI quite a lot to write my book, and that worked very well. If you want to write short snippets of code and do it step after step, you can increase your speed quite a lot by not typing at all. You need to be very clear on your prompt, and then you can refine it from there. You still, of course, need to understand what code does. For me, it was important to read what AI had written and spot any bugs. But this is kind of the key part. So
did you recognize yourself? That you asked me.
Definitely was very good with the kind of storytelling part. Wanted to write a book that is really written in a story and not so much a fiction book or a non-fiction. Okay, as we're approaching the end, let's get into some summary statements. Flaminia, what's your key takeaway for the audience from our discussions today?
As a statistician, I suggest everyone to be open to innovation, not scared, ask for support whenever needed. We will interact more and more between departments and over different specialties. And that's the beauty of brainstorming, of being a statistician. We can only grow through this collaboration.
Thanks so much. What about you?
I think we're living through exciting and challenging times. Critical thinking, like we outlined, and good decision making are critical and things we should focus on, as well as communication. Those things go together because obviously you make a decision, you don't communicate it, things go wrong very quickly. Or convincing people to make certain decisions. We're living in a world where it's cheap to generate data in some way. But we have to remember there are people involved and it's a burden. You can't just collect data all the time. If you have no purpose for the data, I think we're living in that sort of tension right now because these tools are saying, if you've got a bunch of data, you're probably going to derive some insights. But at the same time, we really should be thinking carefully about what data we want to collect, how we want to collect it, what we're going to do with it. And there are regulations and rules in place for that. So you can't just collect stuff just to collect stuff. So I think that's where statisticians also have a role to play in figuring out what are essentially the experiments you want to run, randomized or controlled experiments that may be just collecting data from real world data. But how do you design the experiment, the study to answer the questions that you're interested in answering and making the decisions that you need to make? So I think we have to keep our eye on the ball, even though there's all these things happening and a lot of buzz and advancing technology very quickly.
That was really good speaking with you and getting your insights. It's exciting, right? It's really exciting in what's coming up. And we didn't have the chance today to touch a lot of topics that are impacted as we started to think about how RCTs are changing. We observe the changes over time. There's a lot to come. And that is not only AI, even though we talk about this quite a bit, but it's also about the mindset. It's about the extension of topics that will be on the at the desk of the statisticians and the responsibility of the statistician, or at least in the responsibility of interaction. So that is exciting. When people ask you why I became a statistician, or I'll continue to be a statistician, and it is about the different types of requests coming in every day. It's about different studies, different type of studies, different
methods, responsibilities, etc. And that is just not ending, right? We see that this is becoming more and more, the statistician is becoming more and more important in the current like standard world. I'm excited about this. So that's pretty.
I'm also super excited about these things, because mundane things will be easier. And I think there's a lot of tools that can do things so much easier. I'm just thinking about AI and how it helps me to generate the slides that I want to have, condense it from hours into minutes. So these things will go away. Mundane tasks will free up time for do new and innovative things. We'll definitely need to keep learning the technical elements, human skills, the leadership skill, communication skill. All these will play an absolutely vital role, irrespective of whether you want to work more on the generalist type, the Leonardo da Vinci kind of Renaissance, you know, everything a little bit type, or whether you are a person focused on one specific area where you know a lot of what's going on. Thanks so much for this awesome discussion that we had today. And thanks so much for Saitel for organizing this.
Thank you, Alex. Thank you, Benjamin.
This show was created in association with PSI. Thanks to Rain and her team at VVS. Well, with the show in the background, and thank you for listening. Reach your potential, lead great science, and serve patients. Just be an effective statistician.